Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Greetings. We're going to continue a story we left off with last week. This is about returning a sword to its rightful owner in Japan. In the final days of World War II, an American soldier found a Japanese sword on an Okinawan beach. It bore a tag with a request, one that long went unanswered. 80 years later, he and his grandson, Kevin Krause, set off in search of the blade's owner. And last week, we were talking about the American was in Japan and took it to a sword dealer and to basically get it appraised and see if they can determine its age, where it came from, and who was the maker. And so they're talking about the different tiers of types of blades that are swords that you can have in Japan. So above the four tiers used by the NBTHK, the Nihon Bijutsu Token Hosen Kyokuto, who basically evaluates these blades, are blades that are of extraordinary importance to Japan. For the federal government gets involved and determines whether to designate a blade Bunkenkaizai or Kahuhu, meaning that it's considered a national treasure and must remain in the country, Japanese smiths have made an unfathomable number of swords and fittings. Among them, fewer than 150 have been designated as Kahuhu. Many swords aren't paperable at all. According to Hughes, they aren't significant enough to merit the base level Hosan certificate. We chose not to submit the Umeki sword for Shinza because it wasn't relevant to the act of returning a family treasure. But Saito and Hughes, who are NBTHK members, though they don't perform official Shinzas, agreed to take an informal stab at categorizing the sword. The evaluation we were doing at Seikodo was purely informative. Nevertheless, the sword, according to Hughes, was paperable. Barring something unforeseen that boosted it higher, he presumed that it would be given a Hosan certificate. A blade must be maintained to keep it paperable. This is the responsibility of its current holder or custodian. If this 500-year-old blade was transferred every 50 years to a new custodian, that would make 10 of them. Each had a responsibility to ensure that it didn't rust and wasn't damaged. A break in that lineage could mean the end of the sword in optimal condition. It's a heavy unwritten agreement, one my grandfather certainly wasn't aware of, but the blade had aged well in his care. It could now be professionally polished and properly maintained. 5 centuries ago, someone somewhere on the Japanese mainland constructed this sword, but where and who? Saito and Hughes had given us what they could. We finalized our plan to visit the man they learned from. Michihiro Tanobi tidies his study for no one. It's actually a small apartment dedicated to his things, while he and his wife live in a comparative order next door. The space is overrun by documents and books, blades and sword fittings, the occasional shirt on a hanger that's not hanging on anything, monoplanes, and a Glenn Miller CD. It's a befitting manifestation of a mind full of wide-ranging connections. Hughes and I took the train, both of us with blades in hand, an hour and a half northwest of Tokyo, to Tokorozawa to see Hughes' sword guy. And Hughes' sword guy is the sword guy of all sword guys. Tanobi Sensei studied under Junji Homon and Kenichi Sato, the sword experts who established the NBTHK. The duo had begun working to preserve swords in the years following the war. Approaching post-war occupation leaders, when blades were being piled onto barges and dumped in Tokyo Bay or tossed into furnaces as scrap metal. It was a delicate time to request the liberation of weaponry in Japan, but they hoped to spread awareness of Japanese swords as art objects with significant national and familial meaning. Tanobi estimates that their preservation efforts saved more than 3 million swords from disposal. Tanobi retired from the NBTHK in 2010, but he remains active in the sword community as an author, journalist, teacher, and calligrapher. At Hughes' request, he agreed to inspect the Umeki sword. Tanobi told us his story, mostly in English, between focused evaluations of the sword. The first few times you see someone do this, really inspect the sword, it can come across as a show, a drama even, depending on the person. Tanobi's style is engaging but stops short of theatrical. It's practical and unemotional. He's a doctor who has performed surgery 1,000 times. Tanobi looked at the blade's tip, the kasaki, then shifted his attention to the temper line. A smith can make any number of creative choices when applying clay before heating and quenching. Intricate patterns may be imparted that will then transfer to the steel. These can be obscure or they can be representations of the natural world such as falling leaves, blossoms, or small-scale Mount Fuji. The results of those artistic choices aren't apparent until the blade is heated, quenched, and then handed off to a polisher to complete the shape and finish. Difficult blade, Tanobi said. The attribution process was not going to be straightforward. He tilted his head and angled the sword in the light. Occasionally, he drifted into Japanese and Hughes translated. Focusing on the properties of the steel, someone assessing a blade will note the appearance of its martensite crystallization, which is what Jones in Ohio was looking at when he determined that the blade had been water-tempered. Due to that violent transfer of heat as the steel is quenched, there are near-microscopic features of the metal structure that appear visually distinct. Tanobi brought out a monocle. He was inspecting the pattern left during rapid cooling, a seconds-long event that had taken place back when Hernan Cortez was still alive. Tanobi differentiated between Ni, Naoi, and other features of the steel. Naoi is a more distinct crystalline feature, identifiable stars or bubbles. For example, Naoi is a faint like haze of stars or mist. Both of them can indicate region, school, and Smith. Naoi is stronger than Bizen, Tanobi said, limiting one of the regions under consideration. It was starting to come together. During my time in Japan, Hughes explained roughly 80 centuries of craftsmanship from which a sword's lineage may be traced. While some of the details may be contested, their history, he told me, is generally accepted by the MBTHK and the wider sword community as a useful foundation for their work. In the Kamakura period, 1192 to 1333, Japan's ruling powers brought the country's finest swordsmiths together in the ancient capital of Kamakura to drive the craft forward. From that meeting grew one of the five main sword schools in Japanese history. It was called the Soshuden. It evolving work aimed to meet the need for Japan to defend itself against the recurrent threat of invasion. Goro Nyuro Masume emerged as a leading smith. Masumune is believed to have taught 10 main pupils this technique of Soshuden. It became the golden age of sword making. Those pupils struck out on their own, Hughes explained, and the craft spread to other geographies, evolving in each of the 10. Shuzu Saburo Kanuji style is most often linked to his master, to the point that some of his swords were mistakenly identified as Masamune's. In central Japan, Kanuji's work took hold in what was then Mino province. Fast forward to the early 1500s, and the kind of work being done in Mino province changed, specifically in the town of Seki, 30 miles north of present-day Nagoya. Hughes said that up until that time, many smiths imparted temper lines according to what was essentially a regulated standard. Think of a line running parallel to the cutting edge. Nothing too flashy. Then they began branching out, doing work that felt less restricted. Think of a temper line that resembled rolling waves, a rounded EKG line, rising flames, or a forest. The Umeki sword had fiery-looking peaks running across its temper line. Tanobi put the sword back in its scabbard and opened a black leather-bound book called the Nihonta Maiken. It detailed over 20,000 swordsmiths from recorded Japanese history. Interesting blade, he said, making notes on a pad. He removed the sword again, presumably to check it against information from the book. Then he handed me his written attribution. He believed that the blade, with its temper line, curvature, tip, and crystallization, was made in the Seki area during the first part of the 1500s. As the work of Kanuji's disciples changed, some previously common features disappeared. Tsunagashi was one of those features, Hughes said. The term refers to patterns that look like the remnants of swept sand. And Tsunagashi was one of the details that Umeki sword lacked. Otherwise, Tanobi might have dated the sword to 1300s. You can look at a blade and consider what you see. You also have to consider what you don't see. Tanobi's attribution is to two smiths, a father-son duo named Kenobu and Nobutsugo, working in Seki in the Aisho era, 1504-21, and the Daiei era, 1521-28. The attribution isn't certainty, but instead a very educated guess, as is the case for many swords. The sword Benny found is far from a national treasure, but it is still a distinguishable level of work from a very different time. Good blade, Tanobi relayed. Difficult blade to attribute, but good blade. Good enough to give back. Part 4, Proximity. Nichinan, Miyazaki Prefecture, Japan, July 2nd, 2022. The crowd had gathered before my arrival on the second floor of Umeki's Nichian home. The focal point of the room was a wooden sword display crafted by 97-year-old Takemitsu Umeki. In the weeks before my arrival, the two upright supports awaiting the return of his father's blade. It sat beside a shrine in flowers. Behind the stand was a framed black-and-white photograph of a Japanese soldier with his hand on the grip of a sheathed katana. Chairs around the perimeter of the room were occupied, except for one next to me, reserved for my family's tiny faces on a laptop screen. National and local media were interested in the story, so television cameras and journalists stood behind those seated. The room of perhaps 25 people had serenely greeted me as I walked in with the wrapped sword. My parents were with Benny at the Franklin Park's kitchen table. Like Takahara, where Tomaseku lived, Nichian is on the island of Kyushu. There in the 13th century, the Mongols twice attempted invasion under Kublai Khan, the grandson of Genghis. Typhoons hit and disrupted Khan's plans. The word kamikaze entered the Japanese language to describe the force that had deterred the conflict. For most of the 700 years, the term had existed. The meaning of kamikaze had nothing to do with suicide missions. Kamikaze means divine wind. The utility of a sword also evolved. The Mongols were well-armored, so the structure of the Japanese sword changed. And Soshu smiths pursued a heavier, longer design capable of piercing armor, according to Japanese lore. Perhaps 250 years later, based on Tanobi's estimate, the Umeki sword at its original length had been based on that style. Ahead of the meeting, I had outlined the parts of the sword story I would share. Takemitsu and Mitsuku's granddaughter, Maise, translated. May not have been the story Tomosuke would have passed down to them, but it was the best I could offer. I couldn't tell the family how it had come to possess the sword generations prior, but at least I could give them a place to start. Seated, I picked up the sword and untied the orange tassels on the decorative bag given to me by Hisashi Saito back at Sekido, made of soft olive-brown cloth with an orange and white floral pattern. I removed the sword and placed it on my lap. Then I held it horizontally and stood to meet Takemitsu Umeki, who stood with me. I bowed, offering the sword, and in Japanese said, Umeki-sama, anato no nihonato, watashi no sufukara. The phrasing had been cleared with Yutaka, and I had practiced it repeatedly in front of a mirror at three different hotels, my bow never as straight as I wanted. It was the simplest way I could find to express in Japanese what I was doing. Mr. Umeki, your Japanese sword, from my grandfather. We held the sword together for a moment, and then I released it as my grandfather watched. Here was a 99-year-old man returning a 97-year-old man his father's sword after 77 years. Then it was placed atop the display by Takemitsu's son, Toshihiro. The blade finally home two generations later without missing one. The media left, and I got to speak more informally with the Umekis. I met Kazuaki Umeki, the nephew of Tomosuku from Takahara, who had given Takemitsu's phone number to Gaiku, then Takahuru town employee. After my grandfather and I sent the letter to Umeki's, it made its way to Kazuaki in Takahuru. Through tears, he read the letter aloud to a photograph of Tomosuku, hoping that his uncle would hear our words. Daigaku all had also made the trip to Nichinan to witness the return, another extraordinary act from a stranger. I was able to thank him and tell him that none of this would have happened without him. When we couldn't express something properly because of the language barrier, we put our hands on our hearts and looked at the person we were speaking with. We'd say something like warmth. Closeness can be achieved despite language barriers. You find a way to understand. Takemitsu's daughter, Yoriko Shiwa, recalled her deceased grandfather, Tomosuku, memories she hadn't had in decades. Takemitsu's daughter-in-law, Yukie Umeki, said she felt closer to a man she'd never met. They put their hands over their hearts and said that they felt him. The spirit of the past is being passed on, Takemitsu said through an interpreter, and then spoke briefly of the importance of what we were doing in a traditional Japanese sense and how that had changed more recently in Japanese culture. The ideologies that come with the katanas are so ingrained with what we are that I find it to be very important. But the way people are educated now is very different than in the old days. So I don't know if it translates to a new generation, but I like the fact that the spirit of the past is being honored right now. What Takemitsu said stirred up complex feelings for me. Given the history I'd been studying throughout this process, I hadn't questioned the importance of the katana in Japanese culture. Rather, I had considered World War II's larger history. In the years leading up to the U.S. involvement in the Pacific, the Imperial Japanese Army did deplorable things in China that amounted to mass murder as well as rape, torture, medical experimentation, and forced labor. Some Japanese officers and soldiers were tried by an Allied military tribunal and sentenced to death for their war crimes, but many more were never prosecuted. In our communication before I went to Japan, the Umekis were forthright about the fact that Tomosuke had spent most of the war in China. I considered this before finalizing plans to return a sword that still wore its military fittings. I asked the Umekis if Tomosuke had ever been implicated or charged in any of the atrocities, and they said that he had not. Tomosuke's military records, which I had translated, made no mention of war crimes and do not place him in the Nanjing, where the Japanese military massacred more than 300,000 Chinese civilians in 1937. Those records also indicated that Tomosuke had not been made a colonel until nearly the end of the war. He was promoted in 1945 in Korea, but he was a battalion commander in May 1938 and was in combat in China on and off from 1937 to 1943. In deciding to return the sword, I focused on this. Maintaining possessions would have kept it in my family as a Japanese military weapon and nothing more. Doing so felt like an act of perpetuating division and silence, however small the scale. Returning the sword took it out of its military fittings and revealed a history far greater than several years at war. It brought two families together with acts of kindness on both sides. That day in their home, the Umekis were the ones to bring up the ugly nature of those times in their country. In elementary school, we were taught that we needed to go with the country, Mitsuku said by translator. Mitsuku, 88 years old, was among the generation who saw nationalism change from being the dutiful way of life in Japan to something that should be questioned. In contrast to now, where it's a democratic society and we honor the individual. It's so different because it used to be about there being one single goal you had for your country to prevail. It's not just about focusing on your own country anymore. It's much more than that. It's about learning to live together peacefully. The spirit of the past was being honored and questioned at the same time. But the story of the past was still incomplete. I asked Takemitsu whether his father had been on Okinawa during the war. He confidently said that he hadn't. Military records confirmed this. I asked if his father had been a prisoner of war. Again, he said no. We don't know how the sword got to Okinawa. My grandfather is as certain of the passage of 77 years allows that he acquired it in Okinawa, that it accompanied him in his duffel bag on a landing craft all the way to Incheon. Because he would have passed the Korean island Jeju from Okinawa to Incheon, this gives me some pause. We know from Tomoseki's military records that he was in Jeju at this time. Could my grandfather have stopped there and picked up the sword after the Japanese surrender? It's possible, but he remembers having it with him when he left for Korea. Benny's military records were lost in a 1973 fire at the National Personal Records Center in St. Louis. His memory and notes are what we have to go on. His notes mention every place he went from Seattle to Incheon and made no mention of Jeju. There was time after Japanese surrender and before Benny's departure from the country for the sword to make its way south across the sea from Korea, perhaps as part of a weapons dump. But that's speculation. When we can't explain something logically, when there are gaps, we jump to divinity. Perhaps divine winds. Riku no Koto. So close yet so far. Inaccessible despite proximity. It felt like the right time to stop prodding the past. It seemed like I may have been the only person who cared about those details. Part of the story of Umeki's sword may have been lost, but the sense of unfinished business dissipated. The mayor of Nichion came to express his gratitude and suggested displaying the sword in the town. That night, we had the uncomfortable experience of seeing ourselves on the news. The next day, newspapers reported the return of the blade in Japanese and English. People from the sword community reached out. Portions of the story were gone, but a new chapter was being written. Part 5, Grandfather. Aijima, Okinawa Prefecture, Japan, July 2nd, 1945, and July 5th, 2022. For as long as my grandfather has spoken to me about war, he has valued the individual caught in the conflict. He's now a 101-year-old man living on his own, sometimes desperately doing all he can to maintain that independence. He's still of the belief that the average Japanese soldier wanted to be fighting no more than he did. I think the message on the sword's tag, with its reminder of the name and generations of another family, helped him believe this whether he knew it or not. Tomosoku wrote it with a voice that expressed humanity during a time when it was difficult to do so, asking an enemy for assistance. The sword was very much a weapon to Benny then, but over time it became anything but. When I saw the tag, I knew it meant something, he'd said. He'd said some variation of this line to me more than any other while going through this process. It was clear that he wasn't referring to the literal meaning of the tag. The sword won't be passed down through generations in my family as we once thought it would be, but Benny's mindset of being able to consider the humanity he shared with a single person in an overwhelming conflict already has been. I spent the days following the sword's return on Okinawa. I went by ferry to Aijima. As part of Japan, off the Okinawan coast, Aijima is an island. On it remains the main geographical marker in all the Western Pacific that allows me to identify where my grandfather was with any level of specificity. It's in a photograph on April 18, 1945. American journalist Ernie Pyle was killed in Aijima. Before his death, he wrote stories about ordinary soldiers. A temporary monument to Pyle was constructed the day of his death, and a permanent one was unveiled in a dedication on July 2, 1945. At some point that summer of 1945, quite likely on the day of the dedication, my grandfather had a photograph taken of himself crouching next to it. The monument is still maintained, located atop a mound on a plot of grass surrounded by farmland. July 5th, 2022, I walked out to it from the island's port in the wet heat. It was quiet with a pre-storm stillness. There wasn't anyone around to snap a photo, so I checked the pose in the photograph of the photograph on my phone, then propped the device on a step with the timer set, ran to the monument, situated my feet where he had been standing 77 years before, crouched and posed as best I could as a young Ben Cassett. It started raining, then pouring. I hung my bag in a tree and sat beneath it. I looked over at the white monument my grandfather and I had both crouched next to, our feet as close as they could have been, despite being as far apart as they'd ever been. I thought about one person carrying on another, dependent in mortality. Less so in the Shinto way, because it's not my grandfather's sword to live on in. It's easier for me to grasp living on in a gesture and act. Benny's life will be remembered as a series of small acts of entertainment and large act of kindness. Returning the Umeki sword may be the last and greatest of those acts. Eventually a taxi pulled up. A middle-aged man emerged, striding enthusiastically unfazed by the rain, while the driver waited. He took a series of photographs of the monument and went to the taxi to ask about a ride. The man returned, wordlessly understood my situation, and gestured for me to share the car. One of us said, Ernie Pyle, as if to express interest or inquire to the other about being the only other person out here in the rain on island. I showed him the photo of me posing. He nodded politely. I showed him the one of Benny posing and recalled the word Sofu, grandfather, from my pronouncements to Takamitsu. He lit up, gesturing with his phone to ask permission to take a photograph of a photograph of a photograph. Back in Maumee, Ohio, Mark Jones, after inspecting the sword and before signing it back into its scabbard, had picked up a microfiber cloth and carefully wiped the blade. He explained that this was important because any handling could leave permanent fingerprints. I didn't think anything of it at the time, aside from how it was meant to a helpful tip for preserving the sword. But you deconstruct the sword to reconstruct the story. The next day, back in Franklin Park, and before sending the sword ahead, I had some photos taken of my grandfather with the relic he'll never see again. I removed it from the scabbard, touching only the handle, and placed the gleaming blade in his age-lined roofer's hands, having him pose as if it were an offering. It felt contrived, just as my Ijeoma pose would, but the contrast of the moment was real. The sword was an antique crafted well enough to shine for 1,000 years, an object 500 years old, having passed through generations of hands and conflicts, supported for a moment by weathered palms and fingers 400 years younger, hands too soon be gone, but still part of the story. I had the thought to wipe the surface down, but ignored it. And when we were done, my grandfather moved one hand from the blade to the handle, supporting the sword's weight while he moved his other off the blade to reach for the scabbard. He picked up the sheath, the tips of his straightened fingers, the last mass to touch the steel, before he slid the blade back in for the final time and sent it to a place he felt too weak to reach. So that was an article by Kevin Krause, who's a writer based in Colorado. His work has appeared in The Best American Travel Writing, about returning a sword to its rightful owners in Japan. And next up, we have the 50 most epic adventures in North America. Some hard, some not so much. Behold, we redefine the modern adventure's bucket list. Classic trips have been reconsidered. You've gawked at the Grand Canyon, but have you run it from rim to rim? While new destinations have caught our eye, this year we're joining the revelers at Colorado's Red Rocks Amphitheater, trekking up Mexico's tallest volcano, paddling through the world's brightest bioluminescence off Puerto Rico, hiking Canada's wilderness, coastal, highway, and much more. What do these trips have in common? They're incredible experiences, all. So first up, we have Backpack Utah's Aquarius Trail. This young trail system in southern Utah gets 5 stars for fun. Starting at 11,307-foot summit of Bryan Head Park, its roller coaster is 190 miles east along single track and forest service roads to Escalante, crossing the Aquarius Plateau at elevations higher than 10,000 feet, and skirting Zion and Bryce Canyon National Parks. How hard was it? Enough to feel exhilarated upon reaching my hut. Shipping containers stocked with food, beer, and bunks each afternoon, open June through October, 5-day trips starting from $990. Summit Mexico's highest peak, 18,491-foot Pico de Orizaba, is perfect for beginner mountaineers seeking high-altitude experience. No technical climbing is required, but you'll use crampons and an ice axe on the steep glacier near the summit. I climbed this dormant volcano in May 2021 myself. However, Sir Mont, a family-owned outfitter, in nearby Tlachacuca, has been guiding trekkers up the mountain since the 1930s. I sucked wind during my 5-hour ascent, but the view from the top at sunrise was sublime. With some cream-colored clouds veiling the plains thousands of feet below, and to the west, Orizaba's silhouette falling across the smoke-belching behemoth of Popocatépetl, Mexico's second-highest summit. Stargazing at Texas Greater Big Bend International Dark Sky Reserve. I swam among the stars one night at the world's largest dark sky certified place, the inky Turrilingua Creek, reflecting innumerable twinkles around me. There was no bad spot for a cosmic adventure amid the 9 million plus combined acres of this reserve in southwest Texas. But choice spots include McDonald Observatory near Fort Davis, with giant telescopes, Big Bed Ranch State Park, which hosts free ranger-led star parties, and 2 astro-focused lodges, Marathon Motel, RV Park and Sky Park, and Summit at Big Bend from $15 and $159, respectively. Or spend a long weekend at Blackberry Mountain in Tennessee. From the hot tub of the Blackberry Mountain Lodge in Walland, I understood why these hills are called the Smokies. Low-lying clouds rolled among the same trees I'd commune with earlier in the day during a trail run. You can spend your time here in countless other active ways, off-roading the resort's Lexus GX, testing your balance on a ropes course, or hiking to waterfalls, or a 22-foot troll sculpture in the woods, all of which will leave you sore in a good way. Hence the hot tub, where Blackberry Farm, its Down Valley sister property, leans into culinary pursuits. The newer 5,200-acre Blackberry Mountain is decidedly more outdoorsy. Sipping beer at the Fire Tower Restaurant, perched at the resort's highest point, is a delight, as is a stay in its modern treehouses, where you can watch mist weaving through the branches from floor-to-ceiling windows while curled up in bed. With no shortage of great views at Blackberry Mountain, this one just might be tops, and that's from $1,995 per night, 3-night minimum. Or Hut Hop in New Hampshire. One of the best ways to experience the White Mountains Presidential Range is hiking between the Appalachian Mountains Club's 8 historic high mountain huts. Connecting distances aren't ridiculous. The shortest leg is 4.5 miles, the longest 13.4 miles. From late spring to early fall, On-site staff make guests hot breakfasts and dinners, but I prefer to visit during the shoulder seasons when rates are cheaper and I can cook my own meals. My favorite hut is Zealand. The wood-burning stove keeps the bunks toasty on chilly nights. Intent on summer stay? Book on the AMC site 3 months in advance from $74. See a California super bloom. As I cruise through Anza Borrego Desert State Park one April afternoon, the road curved to reveal a seemingly infinite carpet of purple and yellow. Caught unawares, I felt like I entered Oz. A super bloom. The rare phenomenon occurs when consistent, above-average rainfall follows a drought, nurturing a floral explosion so vast and vibrant that it's visible from space. I've since seen superblooms in Death Valley National Park and Mojave National Preserve. They're not limited to Southern California, though. For more info on possible places these awesome ephemeral displays might appear in 2025, check out the nonprofit Theodore Payne Foundation. Or backpack the West Coast Trail in British Columbia. A six-day trek along this 47-mile Vancouver Island Trail exceeded all my expectations. The route ambles between mossy rainforests and sandy stretches where black bears forage and orcas and gray whales breach offshore. Wooden landers and boardwalks keep the hike engaging, and a dozen established campgrounds mean tent sites are plentiful, but also popular. Prepare to get cozy with your neighbors at Tusiat Falls especially. I found solitude at Coolette Cove and Carmanah Creek. Download the West Coast Trail app to stay abreast of camping options, conditions, and tide info. And pack motion sickness meds for the bumpy shuttle back from the far trailheads. Permits and mandatory ferry reservations, which do not include Pacific Rim National Park Reserve entry, go on sale each January and sell out within hours. And that's from $154. And ride horseback in Canyon de Chelly in Arizona. One May day, mounted atop two small horses, perfect for our short frames, my teenage daughter and I followed a Dene woman and her preteen son up the low brown waters of Chinle Creek and into the deep ochre Canyon de Chelly. Indigenous people have lived here for 5,000 years, and the only way to explore the canyon today was a native guide. Zara's narrated her tribe's history, she pointed out petroglyphs of hunters, snakes, the god Kokopelli, on the sheer 1,000-foot-high walls and fielded queries about modern life in the Navajo Nation. On the return, the boy spotted a herd of wild horses and broke away from our equine train, chasing them through an open field surrounded by cottonwoods. The whole outing felt timeless. Justin's Horse Rental is the canyon's only authorized horseback outfitter, and that's from $30. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.